And my guest today is journalist Diana Johnstone. She has a long and distinguished career as both a writer and political activist, having organized during the Vietnam War the first international contacts between American citizens and Vietnamese representatives. Much of her adult life has been spent in France, where I first interviewed her for Takes on the World back in 2007. She was the European editor of the U.S. Weekly In These Times. She was the European editor of In These Times from 1979 to 1990 and was press officer of the Green Group in the European Parliament from 1990 to 1996. She is also a regular contributor to the online magazine Counterpunch and the author of three books, The Politics of Euro Missiles, Europe's Role in America's World, published by Schocken Books in 1985, Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, published by Pluto Press in England and Monthly Review Press in the United States, in 2003, which took a different look at the Serbian-Bosnian War and set up a great deal of controversy, and Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton, published by Counterpunch in 2015, about which I interviewed her a year ago in November. It's a book whose contents are still very relevant. She's just returned from Paris, from a trip to Rome, where I mentioned earlier the people voted overwhelmingly to reject changes in the Italian constitution requested by its prime minister, Matteo Renzi, who promptly resigned. Welcome once again, Diana, to Takes on the World.
Well, glad to talk to you again.
Yes. Well, lots changed since our last conversation a year ago, and a lot has stayed the same. People are still absorbed here in our own presidential elections and its aftermath, and what effects it has had on European politics is something we're going to talk about today. You just come back to Paris from Italy, where they've just had their own balloting, where probably it took priority over what was happening here.
Well, yeah, but it's all very confused because it was interesting to be in Italy because people seem to be more open-minded than in France. They have a different take on a lot of things, the people I ran into. You know, it's a big country, everybody's mixed up, but France is very conformist, very much on the American line, whatever the American line is. The media here are totally on the American line, and Italy is not so much so. One big difference is that in France, there's a huge uproar. They treat Aleppo as a new Srebrenica. I mean, even before anything happens. I mean, they've announced ahead of time that this is going to be a genocide, a massacre, et cetera. They don't wait to see what happens. That's decided ahead of time, and they're all going through that. Whereas in Italy, and it probably has to do with the presence of the Vatican, the attitude is completely different because there's great concern for the survival of the Middle Eastern Christians, and so there they tend to be all on the side of the Syrian government, which is the only protection that the Christians have.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Aleppo. We seem to have tweets and phone calls and all kinds of recoveries, but there's no Western reporters there. All the reports are funneled from an area. Granted that there's been terrible destruction there and loss of life, but that has been controlled by the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, and the papers no longer report that the United States had asked the opposition in Syria that was not connected to al-Nusra to disconnect itself from it, and it didn't do that. It hasn't done that. And despite the stories we hear of people being trapped and unable to leave, even the New York Times has published pictures of large numbers of people going into the government health section, which is the largest section. It also has been subjected to repeated shelling by the al-Nusra people. They're not rebels, they're foreign fighters, not Syrians. We never hear any of them interviewed, or we never get any tweets from them. And obviously, if you're not on the side of the opposition to Assad, you're liable to be killed, which we found that before. So it's the reporting is really very strange, and I also wonder what it would have been like if during the U.S. bombing of Vietnam, we heard from Vietnamese who were running and hiding while they were being blown to bits by American aircraft.
Well, actually, we heard more about the Vietnamese side during the Vietnam War than we hear about the other side now. The fact is that the censorship of the media is stronger than it was then. There were American reporters who criticized the U.S. war effort. There was criticism of it. They've clamped down completely, and now the media in the United States and also in its satellite, France, all tell the same story. And in fact, in France, it may be even worse than in the United States. It's totally on one line. And, of course, the real point is that all of this is there's a war against Syria, which is in the interest of America's so-called friends in the Middle East. I mean, the destruction of Syria, and I say the destruction, not just the change of government, but the destruction of Syria is on the top of the agenda for Israel and for Saudi Arabia. So there are two friends who probably don't love each other too much, but they're both our friends, and this policy against Syria is for them and Qatar and Turkey, who want to divide up Syria in various ways. And so the United States is showing itself as a very bad loser, and by the United States I also mean the establishment, and I mean the Obama administration. They didn't want to lose the election. They didn't want to lose the war in Syria, and they're very bad losers. So when they lose, they just claim that it's because of fake news and Russians. I mean, they just can't accept the fact. I mean, they're in total denial on every level.
Well, this even and there seems to be a despite the so-called information highway, the gap in information and knowledge seems wider than ever. We could even tie it in with the so-called the accusation that Russia has been behind the leaks and interfering with U.S. elections. As if hypocrisy has no bounds. This country, which I mentioned before I called you, has interfered with so many elections, has overthrown so many legitimate governments. And in fact, the interfering with the elections was not done by the Russians, but was done by the Democratic National Committee, which we don't even hear about anymore.
Well, no, I mean, this is just, I must say, I am just flabbergasted. This Russian interference in the election is so absurd, so ridiculous, so absolutely far-fetched that I just cannot believe that any sane person believes it. But it's being echoed by the media and all over the West. I mean, they just come up with the most completely absurd story possible to try to discredit the election of Trump, because frankly, election of Trump is not in their plans. Just like the failure to overthrow Syria is not in their plans. And by their plans, I mean the plans of the ruling Western establishment and NATO, which is to weaken Russia, overthrow the troublesome states in the Middle East, which they've largely done except for Syria. And Trump comes along, and for all of his faults, he's not on the inside of these plans, and they just don't want anyone in there who's not part of their plans, and so they're just going berserk to make up these absurd, absolutely, totally ridiculous accusations. I suppose still with the hope of getting the Electoral College to reverse the results.
Well, they need 37 to change, and President Obama has asked for a report before he leaves office, before he turns it over to President-elect Trump about the findings of the CIA on this report. But it's extraordinary that, as Peter Van Buren, who is a former 24-year veteran of the State Department, said, that even the progressives and the left who have over the years criticized anything put out by the CIA have jumped on the bandwagon. I heard Tim Weiner of The Nation on the program yesterday, The Takeaway, in which he talked about U.S. history of interfering in other elections, which you won't hear on NPR. But he also joined in saying that the Russians were behind this. It's totally extraordinary. People are so shocked that their candidate Hillary Clinton, whose foreign policy they totally ignored during the campaign, didn't get elected. And instead of addressing their fury at the Democratic National Committee for foisting such a candidate on down their throats, with such contempt for the Democratic Party voters, they are now blaming the Russians. It's extraordinary.
Well, it's extraordinary in every possible way. For one thing, it's obvious that the Russians, who absolutely do not want to go to war with the United States, might just possibly prefer a candidate who doesn't want to go to war with Russia. I mean, that's obvious enough, because Hillary was right on the road to war with Russia with her no-fly zone in Syria, was heading right for war with Russia. And so, of course, they may, but that doesn't mean they can do anything about it. I mean, this is, Putin said, but I don't know if his word should be echoed over and over, that as far as he had heard, the United States was not a banana republic, which could be, whose government could be overthrown, by some hackers or something. So this was he had heard that the United States was a great power and could probably defend itself. I mean, it is so bloody ridiculous that I just can't believe. I was in Italy and I'm talking to people saying, what this revealed, this whole election, all this furor, is the drastic cultural, political, intellectual decline of the United States, that it's just fallen through the bottom, into total infantile stupidity.
Well, as H.L. Mencken said, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people.
Well, I don't even know about the American people, because this uproar is not really from the American people.
That's true.
It's from the American media, the American establishment, and unfortunately, a part of the identity politics left, which rushes out and demonstrates against an elected president instead of organizing to defend whatever it is they want to defend. I mean, that is also infantile.
The very same people who did not mount any protest against U.S. war and atrocities in Iraq or Afghanistan. Just at the end of the Bush years and the Obama years, I've talked about that in the past. It's extraordinary what has been put up with under the Obama administration, which is the reason I believe he was selected to be president, to put a human face on U.S. imperialism. And people still think, despite being the assassinator-in-chief and deporter-in-chief, that basically he's a good guy. And that's the appearance that those who put him in power wanted to portray to the American public, and it succeeded.
Well, that's why the next chapter was supposed to be a woman. First a black and then a woman, because that shows how diverse and advanced we are. Goody. And you see, they didn't get their way, so they're absolutely frantic. But that's the president is there also for public relations. In fact, everything is public relations. I mean, the whole political system now is public relations. There's no serious argument. You had a whole election campaign without any serious debate, with just insults and public relations. I say that's part of the. That's when the Italians were saying, "Well, we know that the United States is makes terrible wars, and we're used to that, but we always thought that America was still sort of a great country and, good people. And now they've been revealed that even at home they're terrible."
Well, from there, let's actually look at what's happening over on your side of the Atlantic. You just came back from Italy, and tell us what happened in that election that caused Matteo Renzi, the
Well, you know, I'm not going to go too far on that, because what happened is basically that everybody ganged up against Matteo Renzi because it's partly the same thing you see all over now. The fact is that all over the West, not only the United States, but their satellites in Europe have all been sold on the TINA policy. There is no alternative. There is no alternative to globalization, which means that people lose jobs and security and so on. There is no alternative to this a certain kind of very pretentious moralizing leftism, which leaves behind the working class and not just the working class, but the middle class, everybody who isn't super rich. And the problem is that the classic historic alternatives to that is the communists, the social democrats, the real left have been destroyed. They've been destroyed largely from within. I mean, they've been taken over. They've been infiltrated. They've been turned into identity politics, clientele organizations. And so there isn't any real left. So there's Italy shows that very much, because there's just a rebellion against what is there. And you have the same, you have similar thing in Spain, except I think the Italians may go a bit farther with it, because the country is in debt, because of the euro, because of course that's part of globalization. You have to be part of the euro. You have to do this. You have to do that. And people are sick and tired of voting for the traditional parties, and they can vote on the left and they can vote on the right, and they get exactly the same thing with a slightly different sales pitch. And there's really where this will lead, I can't tell you, but there's a kind of falling apart phenomenon.
Well, in France, it's become quite scary, and even actually in Germany. But talk about France, the Hollande has been such a failure, as a so-called socialist, that's not running. But those who are going to be running, the three candidates at the moment, Marine Le Pen, Manuel Valls, and François Fillon, are all disasters of varying degrees, no?
Well, certainly François Fillon has come out with the most right-wing social policy you could imagine for France. So that he actually, François Fillon now, in terms of domestic policy, he's the far right. He's to the right of Marine Le Pen, because Marine Le Pen, along with her main advisor, Philippot, have moved their party considerably to the left of where it was with her father. They're not on speaking terms anymore, and he's been thrown out of the party. And actually, she's going to be running to the left of Fillon, because she's going to talk about saving jobs. He said he's going to fire 500,000 public servants. She's going to talk about saving jobs and saving social services. Actually, right now, of the three candidates in social policy, she's the most to the left. Then when you get to foreign policy, Valls is entirely on the Israel line. He said he would do anything for Israel and the United States, whereas both Fillon and Marine Le Pen want to normalize relations with Russia. And since it's likely that one of those two, rather than Valls, wins, the prospect is for France to change its foreign policy rather significantly.
Now, it's interesting you brought that up, as I mentioned earlier, before I called you, that what we most Americans aren't aware of and is buried in the New York Times but never mentioned on National Public Radio is that other than the UK, other than Britain, most of the European countries are not happy with the sanctions against Russia. They don't feel threatened by Russia, and they rather do business with Russia. And they've lost a lot of business because of the sanctions of Russia, which in turn sanction them rather than doing business. And the U.S. has to force most of those countries to pay at least 2%, which you're supposed to do as members of NATO. But it's one of the fears that was mentioned here with the absence of Britain through Brexit, that the leading voice of the U.S. voice in NATO over in Europe would be stifled because it's Britain who keeps pushing their European neighbors to confront Russia. Whereas most of the Europeans, I found this even during the Cold War when I was living in Europe, that even though they didn't like the Soviet Union, they weren't afraid of the Soviet Union. It was all trumped up for American business and building weapon systems.
Well, yeah, of course, if the Europeans are supposed to be scared enough to buy American weapons, you know, that's the idea. If you're scared, oh, the Russians are coming, then you have to buy all these expensive military equipment from the United States. It's a big market. And, of course, there is a traditional anti-Russian feeling in the Baltic states and Poland, which is for historic reasons. But, you know, that could easily be assuaged because, you know, I mean, Russia's not going to attack the West. But the United States finds it easy to stimulate those fears so that it has somebody that in Europe. But you notice that the recent elections in both Romania, in Bulgaria, which is now part of the European Union, oddly enough, and in Moldova, which is not, but it's right next to Romania, they recently elected pro-Russian presidents. So that's very interesting because Bulgaria, they had been very pro-American, and the fact is that I think that Putin, to the great dismay of the Americans, you know, is sort of he appears to be a reasonable statesman in the middle of an insane asylum.
Actually, it seems like a great board game because Putin is in bed. It's like he's playing this game. He's excellent relations with Israel. Netanyahu has visited him four times. He speaks Russian with Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister, the so-called defense minister from Israel, who's from Moldova, former beer hall bouncer. Qualifies him to be Israeli defense minister, of course, with that job. And he also is dealing arms with Egypt. He is actually playing a game of Go where the Washington seems to be playing checkers.
I don't know what they're playing. But you see, it's all their own fault because back in 2013, I find that it's amazing not only how the American media can make up its own fake news, but also how it can forget most recent events that are significant. In 2013, there was this big uproar about chemical weapons being used in Syria. Now, there have been excellent studies since by United Nations and MIT studies have shown that those chemical weapons were undoubtedly a false flag, that it was the rebels that used them precisely in order to incriminate Assad. And Obama was in this position of having said there was a red line he'd cross and would have to bomb Syria. But the British Parliament turned totally against that. Obama was in a spot because there was a lot of, after the British Parliament, House of Commons went against Britain taking part in bombing Syria. There was a big uproar against it in the United States, and Obama was in an embarrassing position. And Russia came along with a face-saving device, which is jumping on the statement of Kerry. They said, well, let's get together and get rid of Syria's chemical weapons. And that was done, and that was a sign of two things. First, that Russia and the United States could work together on a positive, peaceful project and succeed, because this was done successfully. And it was also an opening saying, look, we'll say you're going to lose here, but we can have a face-saving a solution. We all come out as friends. We can all win, et cetera, et cetera. That was really what the Russians were trying to do, to solve the Syrian mess without causing a conflict between Russia and the United States. Now, you look at the media today, and nobody remembers what's happened. They just keep saying, oh, Obama missed his chance. You know, Obama was cowardly and didn't bomb Syria when he should have in 2013. That's been in The Atlantic. I see it in every kind of publication, including in France. The facts of the matter are totally, totally forgotten. It's just amazing. And they talk about fake news.
My guest is Diana Johnstone, and I agree with you. I keep seeing they keep repeating that. And even though Seymour Hersh and other journalists showed that Syria was not involved with this, that it was chemical weapons were being used by the other side that had been sent for that very reason to try and set up Russia. And the fact that Russia, that the Syrians
to set up Assad.
That's correct. That they couldn't actually prove that, and realize that has, as you say, has been totally overlooked by the mainstream media, and they keep going back to Syria's use of chemical weapons. It's a big lie repeated over and over and over again, and now this business with the hacking, with the alleged hacking, is carrying it to a new level of desperation, that this is blamed for the loss of Hillary Clinton, where there are so many other reasons for it, for people staying away from the polls or voting for somebody else. And even people actually, there are people who voted for Obama in the Midwest back in 2008 who voted for him, for Trump, because they saw Clinton as being the same old, and not caring about them.
Well, and look, I think Trump was right when he said that the CIA report is just like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, there's no reason to believe this first. I mean, it's so obviously invented. The FBI doesn't find any. I mean, in fact, even if the Russians tried to intervene by hacking, it would be such a minor event, so trivial, so unimportant, it wouldn't be worth mentioning. I mean, if it were true, it would be nothing, because the influence just doesn't work that way. People voted for Trump because he talked about creating jobs. Now, whether he'll create jobs or not create jobs, I really don't know, but that's the main reason. People are worried about their jobs, and, you know, he said he would create jobs, and he may create a few jobs from some kind of infrastructure project, although it's very unlikely that he can bring back the industry that's already been lost. But he'll probably create some jobs. But for a lot of people, this is the idea that he'll create some jobs. She had no economic policy at all. Bernie Sanders started to have a little bit of one. She had no economic policy. She was simply running as herself. I'm a woman. I'm good. And he's bad. You know, it was like that.
Well, it is interesting. And Sanders, Sanders also didn't have the baggage that she did. I had this vision of a long before the election of a magazine cover with a plane taking off. The plane would be titled 2016 Elections, and Clinton would be standing on the tarmac with 15 pieces of luggage. because she has a record, and that's you could find that record. You could find her laughing at the disemboweling of Muammar Gaddafi and taking responsibility. She was the one who actually pushed for Obama, who was seemed to be reluctant to go into Syria. She actually pushed for that. And Libya opened a Pandora's box of weapons that not only went into Syria and Iraq, but also into Nigeria with Boko Haram. Her hands were on all the major crimes of the Bush administration.
Well, of course, that was the subject of my book, Hillary Clinton, Queen of Chaos. I was about her foreign policy. I didn't get into all of the very unsavory personal stuff. I was just writing about her foreign policy was totally criminal. And the worst of the crimes is the one you mentioned, Libya. I mean, it was the destruction of a country, basically. I mean, it was a brutal murder. It was bombing. It was, but it was it destroyed. It literally destroyed a country that was rather fragile, but that was held together by the personality of the lead of the guide and by social problems. Programs. I mean, there was a very high standard of living because Gaddafi, unlike his enemies in the Arab Gulf states, actually spread the wealth among the people who were quite well off with high standard of living. And all of that has so the whole country has been destroyed. And as you said, it's just become a place for various bands of fanatics to run around with arms and go into neighboring countries and cause trouble all over the place. And that is such a major crime that she was actually wanting to run on the basis of that. It's in some of these leaks, not leaked by Russia, but from her own emails, that her advisors were saying, "Go for it, you know, and you can run for president as for your successful strategy of regime change." Well, they didn't change the regime; they destroyed it.
Well, it's interesting. Throughout the campaign, all the questions. Really had to deal mostly with domestic issues, and she saved her foreign policy speeches for the Washington think tanks. And that's why she was supported by the founders of the Project for New American Century, which have also been given a pass by the mainstream media, such as the New York Times, NPR. They don't talk about these characters who are quite sinister. And they also forget the role of Victoria Nuland, which I repeat often on my program, of orchestrating the coup in Ukraine and bragging about it, which could be seen on YouTube. It's not fake news that I invented. I mean, can you imagine? Here she was, a European, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, marching in a protest against the president, the elected president of Ukraine, passing out cookies. She should have been on the first plane back to Washington.
Well, she was there, and so was Senator McCain, and so was Bernard Henri-Lévy.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the usual suspects were right there to overthrow the government. to do a regime change in order to get an anti-Russian government, and this was right after an agreement had been made for the president to call early elections with international supervision, and they went right ahead with the coup and put in power the person that Nuland had picked, namely Yats. Yats. I mean, this was a U.S.-sponsored coup using real neo-Nazis as the foot soldiers in the streets and in the parliament to intimidate people.
And this is not fake news. It's actually, even the New York Times published the fact that Yanukovych had agreed, after discussion with European countries, Germany, France, and so on, to call new elections, after which he would legally step down, and that's when the United States stepped up the pressure.
That's what I'm saying. There had been with the Europeans an agreement for, but you see, the whole problem is that that country has. There's plenty, you know. You the New York Times. I can't stand the New York Times anymore because I think it's full of fake news. But there's tons of things written about Ukraine. I mean, you know, there are plenty of sources about that, books and serious studies and so on. And the fact is that that country is has only been a country for a very short time and is extremely divided between the east and the west of the country, and the east of the country has always been pro-Russian, and the west of the country has been pro-Western. And the only way is the solution, which is now still on the table and which Russia supports, which is to have a federal system so that there can be some measure of self-government. There isn't in that country. It's quite a large country. It's bigger than France, and it's totally centralized. And the whole solution to that war, which is this agreement that the Europeans sponsored, is simply to enact a federal system so that there can be like local government of some kind. And there isn't under the... And so it's a very easy thing to solve. However, the West does not want to solve it. The United States wants to keep it going because it's the excuse for its anti-Russian campaign. Because they can keep saying, the Russians are aggressors. If the Russians were really aggressors, they'd have taken Ukraine by now. They could. They don't want it.
Well, also, it justifies the continuance of an expansion of NATO, which just before the Ukraine crisis had its own crisis of its own. Well, what good was NATO anymore? People were asking before the Ukraine crisis. So I believe that one of the reasons of causing that crisis was to maintain NATO.
Well, not to maintain NATO, but to advance NATO. And that's why... Putin sponsored the referendum in Crimea, because it was very clear that the strategic plan of the United States was to have a pro-NATO government in Kiev, which would then break the agreement with Russia to allow them to use the naval base, which is the historic Russian naval base in the warm waters in Sevastopol, and so this was a direct threat against the very existence of the Russian Navy. And the fact is that the people of Crimea, from the time that in 1991-92, when Ukraine became, from the very beginning, the people of Crimea were wanting to go back to Russia, which they had been part of, until Khrushchev, without consulting them, gave Crimea to Ukraine. And the Crimean people, the majority, wanted to go back to Russia.
I have to stop you there.
It was a convergence of Russian interest and the interest of the people of Ukraine, of Crimea.
Diana, we've come to the end of a very enlightening hour. Thanks so much for being our guest today, Diana Johnstone. Her last book was Hillary, Queen of Chaos. Anyway, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. Bye-bye. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.